So clearly we can see that rational discourse and debate was insufficient. Clearly we can see that the mechanisms of parliamentary government were insufficient. We need to be able to come up with a way to say, how can we make sure never again? By any means necessary, this can never happen again. And the people back there who witnessed these atrocities committed themselves to that. So the question is, okay, if you don't think that it's appropriate to physically confront and to stand in front of neo-Nazis who are trying to organize for another genocide now, do you do it after someone has died, as they just did? Do you do it after a dozen people have died? Do you do it once they're at the footsteps of power? At what point do you say enough is enough and give up on the liberal notion that what we need to do is essentially create some sort of a regime of rights that allow neo-Nazis and their victims to coexist, quote-unquote, peacefully, and recognize that the neo-Nazis don't want that, and that also the anti-fascists are right in not looking at it through that liberal lens, but rather seeing fascism not as an opinion that needs to be responded to respectfully, but as an enemy to humanity that needs to be stopped by any means necessary.
This is part one of our conversation. Mark Bray will do part two and post it online at democracynow.org. Mark Bray is the author of a book that is coming out in the next few weeks called Antifa, the Anti-Fascist Handbook. He is a lecturer at Dartmouth College. That does it for our broadcast. If you want to sign up for our daily digest, our news headlines every day, you can text the word Democracy Now! Without a space to 66866. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks so much for joining us. You have to just correct.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of National Health Center Week Health Fair Thursday, August 17th at 10 a.m. at the Neighborhood Health Center in Hillsboro. Neighborhood Health Center is a community health center serving residents in Washington and Clackamas counties. The health fair is a collaborative effort to offer health care, education, and support for residents in need and showcase the value for community health centers and their partners. There will be blood pressure checks, glucose testing, dental screenings, as well as information about emergency preparedness, health care, and more. Again, that's the National Health Center Week Health Fair, Thursday, August 17th at 10 a.m. at the Neighborhood Health Center, 18650 Northwest Cornell Road in Hillsboro. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Have you seen KBOO's Fuzzy Boo Van? It's a giant furry blue Muppet mobile that brings music and joy wherever it's found in Portland and across the region. We're having a contest this summer. If you spot the van, post a picture on Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter with the hashtag Fuzzy Boo and you'll be entered to win a chance to have Fuzzy Boo at your event, as well as other prizes. Each picture you take is another chance to win. For more info and clues on where to find the van, go to kboo.fm/fuzzyboo.
KBOO Portland.
Good. And good morning, an oldie but goodie from Quicksilver Messenger Service, Pride of Man. Interesting lyrics. And yeah, we're going to be talking about something we've been talking about a lot. I kind of also would like to talk about all these events going on, what happened in Charlottesville. Last week, we kind of talked about that whole milieu, hopefully gave you a little better understanding of who some of those players were that were marching and caused such mayhem in Charlottesville this past weekend. Today, we're going to continue the conversation that I've been having for quite a while now on the climate crisis that is looming over our heads that we have been experiencing directly here in the Pacific Northwest with our own, to much lesser extent than elsewhere, of course, but extreme weather conditions. And we have on the line from the Bay Area, Richard Heinberg. Good morning, Richard.
Good morning, Paul. Good to be talking with you.
And I had meant to look on the website to see when the last time. I know Andrew Geller had talked with you a couple times. It's been a few years, though, since you've been on KBOO, I believe.
Yeah, at least a couple of years, I think.
And anyway, you're with the Post Carbon Institute. You've written extensively on climate, on energy, on economic and ecological issues. And some of your books are The End of Growth, Our Renewable Future, Snake Oil, How Fracking's False Promise of Plenty Imperils Our Future, and many other books. I was talking to you the other day on the phone, and I had met you at a conference, and it'll be kind of difficult to tie all this in, but maybe we could just touch on it very briefly. There was a conference on Emanuel Velikovsky, and I know that to those who know about Velikovsky, I'm sure he still has a very bad reputation for being kind of a charlatan, scientific charlatan, but I know you have a very different, as well as I do, view of the history of Velikovsky. But I think what's interesting about Velikovsky is this whole issue of catastrophism and how the whole idea that there was this planetary catastrophe, and again, it'd be really difficult to go in depth into this to give people a full sense of what Velikovsky actually was all about. A book called Worlds in Collision was a very famous book. But anyway, the idea that there were these planetary catastrophes in the deep past that had a major impact on the course of terrestrial events was kind of anathema. Nothing was really known about the impact of meteors, about a whole series of events, and whether or not, you know, Velikovsky's scenario that he laid out was actually true. The resistance to his idea of cosmic catastrophes was based upon the sort of idea of that things couldn't have been so drastic. There couldn't have been these huge upheavals, and that turned out to be completely overturned. And now we're facing our own major upheavals and what people call the Anthropocene. We've actually have human beings are actually having influence on the very basic geophysical conditions on planet Earth. So maybe you'd like to, now that I've kind of set you up, talk about how you see your interest in that whole issue of catastrophism and Velikovsky and how it relates to the present.
Right. Well, as you say, the general scientific view of cosmic catastrophes has changed dramatically in the last few decades. Back in the early 1950s, Velikovsky became famous or infamous for writing best-selling books suggesting that there had been cosmic catastrophes within human history. And And at that time, the scientific establishment was very much invested in the idea of uniformitarianism, the idea that the solar system has evolved under conditions that are basically similar to the conditions we observe today. And that view, that uniformitarian view, has definitely been overturned within scientific mainstream. And now cosmic catastrophism is generally accepted, the idea that there have been massive planetary bombardments. There may have originally been more planets than there are today. There may have been collisions between planetoids and so on. But nothing is envisioned to have happened within the period of human history. And in that sense, Velikovsky has, I think, pretty thoroughly been disproven. His ideas, his specific ideas about the nature of the catastrophes he was hoping to unearth through world mythology, those have not been confirmed. So score one for Velikovsky in the sense that he got the idea of the general idea of catastrophism right, but score one for the establishment in the sense that he probably will not be confirmed on the specifics of his story.
Which just to, you know, since people might be, some people might be curious who don't know about this, his idea was that there was a Venus act before it established its regular orbit that it currently has, was sort of a rogue I don't know what you'd call it, comet.
Comet,
you know,
yes.
Yeah, that went through the solar system, wreaking havoc, having a near collision, I believe, twice with the Earth, and creating these massive dislocations, which he believed explained various oral and written mythologies or accounts, like the flood story and others. And as you say, there's scientific evidence has not borne that up.
Right. Now, there is scientific evidence to suggest there have been other kinds of catastrophes within human history, including comet, smaller comet impacts. I'm not talking about the one that finished off the dinosaurs. That was much larger. But on a smaller scale, there probably have been comet and asteroid impacts that may have been remembered in human mythology. When we're talking about human mythology, you know, we're talking about stories that are pervaded with a sense of catastrophism. I mean, flood, fire, strange things happening in the sky. There's if you look at world mythology, it's just, you know, redolent with this kind of stuff. So it's entirely possible that mythology does preserve kinds of cultural memories of these kinds of events.
Well, in the Pacific Northwest, there's certainly native traditions that hark back to, I believe, the volcanic explosion that created Crater Lake, I believe, and
right.
Other ones. I think even the memory of the massive flood that came after the end of the last ice age, where the big ice dam broke in, I believe, in Montana. I believe there are some references to that in native oral traditions.
Right.
Just as a parenthesis. Go ahead.
Yes.
With what you were saying, sorry.
Yeah, it's the one aspect of Velikovsky's narrative that has not been supported is the idea of actual planets like Venus and Mars veering off their courses and coming close to the Earth. And Velikovsky tied the ancient sky gods to these planets, and unfortunately there's no astronomical or other physical evidence that these things actually happen. And these were the central elements of his narrative. So it's no small thing that these were misses in terms of his scientific accuracy record.
Yeah, but that whole idea of catastrophism, it comes up in a slightly different way, I think it might be perhaps related. I mean, that the reason we're talking about this, of course, is the reason I had a number of programs on the subject recently was, well, of course, obviously, because climate change is happening. It's extremely severe, and it's worse than every month worse than climate scientists had anticipated in their most sophisticated models, and having to revise on a virtually monthly basis their predictions of what's actually coming down. But David Wallace's Wells article in the New York Magazine called Uninhabitable Earth has really kind of stoked the conversation, brought it out much further out in the open. And in your article, Are We Doomed? Let's have a talk, was also sort of a, you had been writing about this probably for longer than David Wallace Wells, but you too were sparked to have a conversation both about that and about the kind of things you've been talking about all this time. But the whole idea of catastrophism has been, you know, a very controversial thing, in that, you know, some people think, you know, that talking in very stark, dire terms about climate change can paralyze people and prevent people from acting. Other people think differently. So the whole idea of there was a book on, you know, debating the merits of the whole catastrophist approach that came out, I think, on AK Press a few years ago. Don't have a copy of that with me. But so talk about again, that the Davis Wallace Wells article and your response to it and some of the things you've been thinking about this.
Right. Well, the Wallace Wells article, of course, is focused specifically on climate change. And in my view, climate change is actually a symptom of a deeper systemic crisis of modern industrial civilization. And that deeper crisis, I think, can be best described as overshooting Earth's long-term carrying capacity for human beings. What we've done over the last 150 years or so is we've used the massive amounts of energy from fossil fuels to increase our rates of extraction of materials from the Earth's crust and also living materials, forests, fish, et cetera, et cetera. And our rates of transforming those materials into manufactured products, consuming them, producing wastes. And we're now doing these things on a scale that not only is unsustainable in terms of the amount of resources the Earth can provide, but also in terms of the amounts of wastes that we're producing, one of which is carbon dioxide from the burning of fossil fuels, which is changing the climate. So this deeper systemic crisis, I think, is responsible also for other kinds of problems that we're seeing, including resource depletion, species extinctions, pollution events of many other kinds besides climate change. And until we see the deep relationship between all of these crises, I think we're going to be playing basically a planetary game of whack-a-mole, you know, if we even manage to get the climate crisis under control, then the next thing we'll face may be a water supply crisis, or it could be topsoil. We're eroding topsoils at a rate of about 25 billion tons per year, or the biodiversity extinction crisis. You name it. There's a list of maybe 9 or 12 of these things that are all lined up to become, catastrophic events over the course of this century. We can say, we'll just deal with climate change right now, and then we'll deal with the rest as they come. But Realistically, I don't think that's a winning strategy. Sooner or later, we've got to understand the basis of this systemic crisis that we have overwhelmed Earth's systems with our own human system, both in terms of population and also consumption rates. And that's the real crisis that we need to address.
Well, I'd mentioned you're with the Post-Carbon Institute. We sort of just jumped into the kind of the meat of what we wanted to talk about. And I had wanted to sort of give you a chance to sort of let people know how you found your way into both the Post-Carbon Institute and in general, the kind of work that you're doing. I think it's really interesting for people to understand people's trajectory. So maybe you could just talk a little bit about how you found this work.
Right. Well, I've been interested in human societies, how they change, what has led civilizations in the past to collapse, and so on. These are questions that have interested me for several decades now. And it was in the 1990s that I finally realized that energy was the key to understanding human social evolution. Energy is what does everything for us. Without energy, basically, we can't exist. And human societies have gotten their energy in very different ways, from hunting and gathering, from firewood, from agriculture. And it's just in the last 150 years, as I was saying earlier, that we've gotten the majority of our energy from fossil fuels, which are very different energy sources from anything we had before. Very substantial advantages in terms of the economics, the economic effects of using fossil fuels. They've been extremely abundant, cheap to access, portable, storable. We've been able to do things with fossil fuels that we could not have done with our previous energy sources. But, of course, they have very substantial drawbacks as well, two of which are notable. One is that they are non-renewable depleting resources, so as we burn them once and for all, we are running out of the very resources that make our economy go. And the other drawback, of course, is that as we burn fossil fuels, we release carbon dioxide as a waste product into the atmosphere, and that's changing the chemistry of both the atmosphere and the oceans with a catastrophic effect. So we've really boxed ourselves into a corner. We've become overwhelmingly dependent on these fuels. We've grown our population and resource consumption based on the capacity of these fuels to power our industrial system and processes. But we don't really have a plan B in place at currently. We could talk about nuclear and renewable energy and so on, and we have done considerable analysis and research at Post-Carbon Institute on those alternative energy sources. But my point is that currently industrial societies are in no way prepared to replace fossil fuels comprehensively within a time frame that is realistic in terms of averting catastrophic climate change.
And I'm speaking with Richard Heinberg, a journalist, writer, a lecturer also, or I know you do a lot of talks around on these issues. I'm sure you consult with various groups. You work with Post-Carbon Institute. You've written quite a number of books on all these issues. And this is a talk show. I'm Paul Rowland, host of Wednesday Talk Radio here on KBOO Community Radio. And the number to call in to join the conversation with Richard and myself is 503-231-8187. You know, and I wanted to add, in terms of energy sources, I know this is a kind of a brutal way to talk about this, but I think there's really no other way to look at it but that to look at the brutal use of human slaves, right. African-American people, which, you know, built the U.S. into the kind of power that is initially, along with the, you know, the expropriation of the land of the people who were here before the European colonists. But certainly the slave power was the major energy source that developed kind of the capital upon which industrialization eventually took hold in the United States.
Yeah. Well, strictly speaking, it wasn't an energy source. The primary energy source was coming from agriculture and firewood.
Well, I mean, the human muscle power.
Yeah. Right. Human muscle power was being used as a motive force for doing work, just as animal muscle was a very primary way of exerting energy in order to carry out economic processes. And this wasn't unique to the United States in its early years, although this is one of slavery's last stands. But going back thousands of years, in agricultural or agrarian societies, forms of slavery were quite common, certainly in the Greek and Roman times. And one of the reasons that slavery came to an end in this country is that human muscle power was no match for fuel-fed machinery in just purely in economic terms. Slavery almost certainly would have come to an end one way or another during the course of the late 19th century. But it, of course, as history eventuated, it entailed massive civil war. And of course, I don't want to obscure the moral and ethical dimensions of slavery and of the conflict that ended it. But at the same time, I think it's helpful to see that just in pure energy and physics terms, this was an economic arrangement, and it was one that was destined to end, given the trajectory of the economy.
Well, of course, it also enabled that. It's really a complex history, but the capital developed by, you know, obviously there was great resistance by the aristocratic Southern slave owner, plantation owners, to change, because they were benefiting from that
right.
exploitative system. But the overall I think it's really important, and why these white supremacist so-called alt-right, I've talked to these people at some of their protests and stuff, that there's a total unwillingness to recognize the basic fact of the fundamental role that African-American free labor, slave labor, played in accumulating the initial, some of the initial capital upon which, some of the wealth that was created, out of the northern seaports, who were totally implicated in that whole system, but they built up those rich mercantilists in the north was based upon that basic brute exploitation of human labor. So anyway, just not to belabor that point.
Sure.
So then, of course, the Industrial Revolution, which took place earlier, and was sort of helped fuel the colonization by England of the world. It led to this vast rediscovery of the use of coal, which was an integral part of that in the UK, the United Kingdom, and the development of new technologies to exploit that coal, led to basically what we're in, and then discovery of oil, gas, and all the others to sort of fit in to the system that had been developing to basically burn these concentrated forms of energy. And so we've got this vast world system with all these little fires burning everywhere all the time, constantly, emitting these gases, which have been accumulating, accumulating, accumulating to the crisis point we're at right now.
One of my recent books is called Afterburn, and the introduction talks about what I call the Great Burning. And, you know, we are, as you say, we're surrounded by all of these little fires. I mean, you watch, you go outside and you look at the cars driving down the street. Each one of them has a little explosions occurring on a regular basis, fueled by the gasoline in the tank. And in effect, our streets are rivers of gasoline. It's just that, you know, all the gasoline is hidden away in tanks. We never really see very much of it. You know, you go to the gas station, fill up your car, you don't see the gasoline. These days, you don't even smell it because they've got ways of capturing the fumes.
Thank goodness for the people who pump gas.
Yeah, right, right. But you know, take that invisible stuff away, and the whole thing just crashes down. We are so completely dependent on these fuels at this point that you know, it's going to take a systemic shift in our entire economy to change. It's not going to be simply a matter of shutting down the coal mine and putting up a few solar panels and we can continue living as we are today. Our entire way of life has been shaped by the particular advantages and characteristics of fossil fuels. And as we move to different energy sources, the different amounts of energy available, the different qualities of the energy, different ways that these energies operate, will require profound changes throughout society and certainly in our economic system.
Well, we've got a couple people who've been waiting to join the conversation with Richard Heinberg, so let's go to our first caller. George, go ahead, you're on the air.
Hey, thank you so much for bringing this very, very valuable message by Richard Heinberg to us. I certainly feel he is absolutely right when he talks about deep structural, and I guess I would add process changes in our entire society. And I have a very tiny footnote to what you said about the flood on the Columbia. I believe in John Elliott Allen and Marjorie Byrne's book on the, I can't remember the title, something like Floods on the Columbia, they say there were about 40 of those catastrophic floods. About, I think, 5,000 years apart or so. Maybe I'm getting the number.
Okay, well, George, I think you're taking us a little bit astray from the general thread of the conversation here.
Yeah, I just wanted to add that. There were about 40 of those. But let's get back to Richard Heinberg and the deep changes needed. That's what's important here.
Okay,
I'll hang up and listen. Bye-bye.
Thank you so much. The thing that really galls me that I've sort of expressed a couple times is the amazing, wonderful history and complexity of, you know, that is encapsulated in that statement. These waves of floods, the whole ebb and flow between ice ages and the interglacials and it led to this, you know, basically the ability of our species and certainly the elites of our species to exploit these characteristics, leading to, you know, whether it was using water initially, human labor power, all these things to build up this extremely complex system that we're trapped in. But the fact that, you know, we may not have that much time left to actually understand this amazing, wonderful history. You know, all these biologists who are kind of getting somewhat desperate because these species that they've been studying for so long and all the complex relationships, they're disappearing. So we're losing so much that because of this other human system that's sort of out competing the natural system that depends upon.
Yeah. Well, in this essay that I think you read of mine that maybe led to your asking me to be on the show. It's called Are We Doomed? Let's Have a Talk. In the essay, I basically say that there are a number of educated folks, many of them ecologists, systems analysts, and so on, who have, over the last, maybe going back up to four decades, but probably most of them much more recently, come to the conclusion that we're not going to avoid a crisis, that we're too far along in terms of our dependence on fossil fuels, our size of our population, the momentum of population growth, our dependence on growth in manufacturing and sales and so on. So the kinds of systemic changes that would be required in order to avert some kind of system crash are just too large at this point to contemplate, and the managerial class in society, our politicians and so on, have no appetite for that kind of systemic change. So, we're headed toward the wall. There will be a system crisis of some kind, whether it manifests initially as a financial crash or ecological crisis or all of the above, So the question I'm asking in the article is, what could we do right now that could help that crash be something we could recover from? What processes could we set in motion today, knowing what we know, that could help the survivors of that crash recover at a lower level, perhaps of consumption, perhaps even of population, depending on the severity of the crisis? And this is a conversation I assert in the essay has been going on. I've personally had this conversation over drinks or otherwise with lots of ecologists, of heads of environmental organizations, including people who would never talk about this openly. You wouldn't see it discussed on their public organizational web pages.
Maybe that's part of the problem.
Yeah, well, maybe so. But privately, they'll acknowledge that we're headed toward a systemic crisis of some kind, and these are the questions that get asked, late at night. So I'm kind of outing that whole conversation in the essay and saying, well, look, I don't think there would be much to be gained by advertising and trying to draw millions of people into the conversation, because that's not its nature. And if we could get millions of people to wake up all of a sudden, why haven't we done it so far? But I guess the point is, a few more people involved in that conversation, a few more resources would be good. And there may be some people listening right now who've already, entertained these kinds of radical thoughts, and it might be reassuring to know that there are other people who are doing so as well.
Well, we got a couple callers. Let's go to our next caller. Jill, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I started listening and then called in earlier when you were talking about energy and the demands of the industrial civilization we've had for hundreds of years and how they've only been getting higher and higher. And I am reminded of a book of essays, I think, published posthumously called Beyond Economics and Ecology, The Radical Thought of Ivan Illich. And that is the dominant theme of that collection, is thinking through the way that energy is used and distributed in a social way with many individuals in society, using or interacting with systems that use energy, and how we can think of a lower energy society, a society where we are not dependent on robots building other robots, and this big cascade of an infrastructure. And one of the, I think, key components to like getting beyond the current high demand energy paradigm is how we conceive of consumption, and that there is the consumption of the individual, but many things are quote unquote consumed. You go to Freight Harbor and you buy a hammer and you've consumed it, but in reality you don't consume that or many other durable goods, and they can be shared. And that when we look towards having collections that we share and maintain, not unlike the way that Native peoples would maintain, you know, they would train wild animals to kind of be maintained as an ongoing collection, to be sought after when they needed to get meat. We can maintain collections of all kinds of things, and that would be a much lower energy output than producing individual products for an individually conceived form of consumption.
That's a great comment. And you mentioned Ivan Illich, fabulous thinker and author. One of his other books was called Energy and Equity. I highly recommend that one. And his overall point and yours in your comment is that we're going to have to return to a lower overall level of energy usage per capita through this transition, however we conceptualize it, whether we think of it as a crash and recovery or perhaps a transition away from fossil fuels in a maybe a less scary way of putting it. But there are ways of accomplishing that that could preserve the best of what we've attained over the last few decades, and could certainly supply basic human needs in a way of life that is, from a human standpoint, I think far more satisfying than what we enjoy, if that's the right word, in consumerist, capitalist, industrial civilization. We have altered the human psyche, human society, to suit the economy, the growth-based consumerist economy, and the result has been catastrophic in terms of people's daily lives, their connections with their families and friends and loved ones, their connection with the natural world, their physical health, on and on. Whereas if we aimed for happiness and health as goals in our social and economic process, we could accomplish much more. We could have happier lives while actually consuming far less. And I think that would be the key. I mean, if I were the king of the world sort of thought experiment, I think would certainly lead in that direction. So, again, great comment. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Okay, thanks for calling, Joe. And I just got a couple of announcements for what's coming up this morning on KBWID 9 on Political Perspectives. Walter Johnson describes a river of dark dreams, slavery and empire in the Cotton Kingdom. At 10, Air Cascadia headlines, interviews, and commentary. 10:15, Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. At 11, The Food Show talks to Dub Travis, owner of Dub St. John's, about Support Black-Owned Restaurants Week 2017, plus Laura Shapiro's book, What She Ate, Six Remarkable Women and the Food That Tells Their Stories. And as you know, as a KBWID listener, that we here at KBWID keep you informed and involved, and we do appreciate your continued support. So go to kboo.fm and click on donate if you haven't already and wish to become a member of this station. And of course, we also encourage you to, if you have time, join in our governance, our committees. There's a programming committee, there's various other committees. There's also many volunteer operations. I'm interested in getting people to help out with this program, for example. And you can go to our website, kboo.fm, and look at volunteer and committees and all those other things and familiarize yourself with that. And also listen to previous programs here on Wednesday Talk Radio. Let's go to our next caller without further ado. Sean, you're on the air.
Good morning, Mr. Heinberg. Must have been about 6 or 7 years ago, I managed to get a call into Derek Jensen when he was on a call-in radio show. And the question I asked him was about the pressures people feel to conform to this society. And I said something like, well, you know, families get together maybe around the 4th of July or Thanksgiving. And until we reach a place where mothers and fathers and grandmas and grandpas are bragging about their sons and daughters, say, dropping out and, you know, trying to come up with ideas for creating steady-state economies to, in a socialist way, shrink our levels of consumption. And still that, until that happens, you know, on the psychological level, people are under tremendous pressure, especially from their families and their peer groups, to be ambitious, to be aspirational. And Derek Jensen responded by saying, yes, that really, nothing is going to change until what we hold in esteem is radically altered, what we hold in high esteem. So long as people, like, you know, admire people who are in this arms race of how many master's degrees do you have, or how many doctorates do you have, or what salary are you going to get next year, until what we hold in esteem is radically altered, I don't see much hope for a kind of steady state socialist style economy where we're shrinking our levels of consumption. Thanks. Bye-bye.
Right. Yeah, thanks for the comment. I agree. And that's one of the reasons that, as I was saying earlier, I think it's more likely that we will see a some kind of societal crash and hopefully recovery, as opposed to a reinvention of the system on a voluntary basis that averts a crash. And you know, there are lots of other reasons for coming to that conclusion as well. I mean, the way our economy is set up, as I've used the word consumerist or consumerism already in this hour, and a lot of folks, when they hear that word, assume that it's just sort of an individual proclivity. You know, we're greedy, and so we become consumerist. But actually, that's the way the entire economy is set up. One of the causes of the Great Depression was a crisis of overproduction, and that was solved with advertising and consumer credit, making it more desirable and easier for people to consume more stuff that would cause the wheels of industry to speed up and create more jobs and more tax revenues, more returns on investments, and so on. So until we can restructure the economy away from consumerism, we're headed toward the cliff. But the incentives to do that are lacking. And you know, where can you find a politician who's promising, well, if elected, I will shrink the economy? It's not going to happen. So I think our best hope is for some kind of controlled crash where, back in 2008 when we had the global financial crisis, you know, for a few weeks, everybody was looking at the headlines and thinking, oh my gosh, is it all coming apart? And you saw cover stories on Time Magazine and other, you know, mass marketed media saying, wow, is this a fundamental feature of capitalism, and do we need to rethink our whole economic system? But of course, all that went away as soon as the Federal Reserve stepped in and kind of patched things over. But, you know, when we're in crisis, then suddenly the unthinkable becomes thinkable, and there are opportunities. There are also enormous risks and threats that people have to deal with, and so crisis is no guarantee of positive change. But knowing that crisis is more or less inevitable at this point, I think, opens the way to strategic thinking. You know, how are there ways that we could be prepared for crisis so as to seed the possibility in people's minds now of other ways of organizing their lives and the economy that could have some, you know, long-term durability?
Well, one thing we had also talked about a couple days ago, sort of preparing for this show, is there seems, you know, when we talk about a coming crisis, I of course think, you know, we certainly have been in the midst of the crisis for some time. You're talking about a much more major, like falling apart of sort of the basic nuts and bolts of what keeps the social engines running. Breakdowns in transportation systems, breakdowns in food delivery systems, right. Things that we have a hard time conceiving of, although there are parts of the world that have certainly been experiencing those things. One thing that it still seems kind of a little fatalistic, like we're sort of waiting for something to happen. Whereas, you know, I've been, you know, talking to young people, both about, you know, facing these things, because they're obviously got more years to have to deal with this stuff than you or I do, but also people who are, you know, who are still actively fighting and struggling, you know, engaging in forms older and new forms of activism to try to change the systemic functioning that has led to this, and sort of how do they incorporate these understandings and you know what I come to, like, how do we add to their conversation? You know, I think there's people who are involved in this thing called the Portland Assembly, which are doing things that, you know, people have done in the past, certainly, you know, grassroots neighborhood-based organizing, but doing it perhaps with a sort of a different flavor because of their own understanding of all these different, you know, these different things that they're facing. So how do we, you know, instead of talking about, you know, like a relatively few number of people having this conversation, well, you know, is there a way that we can actually bring these understandings and insights into grassroots direct activism today?
Yeah, well, I hope that the conversation can help inform those kinds of efforts. I don't want to in any way discourage or malign the efforts of folks who are trying to change systems for the better, no matter what those systems are, the economic system, the political system, who are, you know, trying to save endangered species or preserve topsoil or create local food systems, all those things, that's all great work. What I am suggesting is that it may be helpful to have a frame in the back of one's mind of, what if we're not able to avert a crash? What is it that we are doing now that could, you know, in addition to, you know, fighting the good fight, also be planting the seeds for a period of recovery, so that as things get shaken up, they realign themselves along the magnetic field of what we're doing now, what the ideas that we're seeding now, whether it be local organic food systems, or a money system that isn't based on debt and servitude, or you name it, you know, an energy system that is renewable and on a scale that is not disrupting natural systems, and so on.
Well, we've got another caller, Marianne, who's been waiting patiently. Go ahead, you're on the air.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. I hesitated to call in a way because I'm hearing so much good stuff. Anyway, But what I called about was really that I think there's an underlying tension and fear and anxiety in everybody, even if they're not conscious of what's happening or have the understanding that you do. And I think that's what drives a lot of the violence at all levels, whether it's the, you know, white supremacists here in this country or all the Western powers going over to the Middle East and trying to extract resources through military action. I mean, I see an escalation of violence as one of the things that's going on as a result of this impending crisis, but nobody seems to be aware that that's, I mean, it's not even conscious, you know what I mean?
Yeah, that's a great point. Part of what I'm trying to do in sort of naming the underlying crisis of civilization is to maybe help avert some of the blame game, because as systems start to fail, the natural human tendency will be to say, you know, why is this happening? And there will always be folks, opportunists, who will say, well, it's because of those bad guys over there, whether it's immigrants or you name it, whoever the easy scapegoat is, and then you get societies tearing themselves apart, which sadly, very tragically, is what's happening in this country right now.
Yeah.
If we can understand that, we are going through a system change, whether we like it or not, that the way we have set up our system is unsustainable. And so the question is not, you know, can we make America great again? It's can we evolve through this process of failure of current systems and redesign of systems so as to minimize human casualties and come up with the best possible outcome in terms of, as I was saying earlier, human happiness and health and the health of the environment.
Yeah, and what we really need to do is cooperate, not fight each other.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Total agree.
Yeah. Thank you.
Well, thank you for calling, Marianne.
Yeah.
And I think also, along with that, I think there's just this conscious or unconscious identification. You know, obviously, white supremacy is a very extreme, virulent form of this identification with a mutant social form, and sort of people feeling their own identity threatened by these changes, whether it's, you know, this the diminishment of certain amount of white power and privilege in daily life, certain amount of diminishment of that through, you know, the civil rights struggle, and
right.
So people being threatened by that. But I think that there's an identity within, you know, the with the industrial society itself, with you know, the United States as, you know, this whole make America great again. You know, there people sort of, because of our own sense of whatever it is, powerlessness or insignificance or whatever, you know, this sort of this tendency to identify, whether it's with a sports team or, you know, we sort of live vicariously through something else rather than because we're unable to live a, you know, the kind of full satisfactory life that we should be living. So unfortunately, people tend to feel threatened when the source of their identity is being threatened.
And one of the other things that we're dealing with is that, you know, we're a tribal species. We evolved living in tribes, and we have this deep psychological need for a sense of belonging within a fairly small group of people that we know. And commercial, consumerist, industrial society has worked in many ways to break that down so that we, you know, live in larger urban communities where we don't all look the same or maybe even speak the same language and so on. But in some ways, that has worked against our own evolution. So we move around easily. We get on airplanes. We change jobs, and so that basic sense of tribal identity that was, you know, psychologically very rewarding, gets eroded. And then when someone comes along who can appeal to that sense of tribal identity and say, well, we'll make our tribe great again, can stir up a lot of trouble. So what we really need to do is not, you know, deny that aspect of ourselves, that evolutionary background, but find ways of satisfying that sense of belonging, of group identity, that are pro-social, that work in favor of everyone rather than excluding or demonizing and scapegoating.
Well, on that extremely complex, long thought, we're going to have to end it, Richard. Wish we could have gone on, but we're plumb out of time. So thank you so much, Richard Heinberg. Go to kboo.fm/Wednesday Talk Radio to look at some links and find out more. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you, Paul.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Books and Records! Books and Records! Come on down to KBOO's annual used book and record sale on Saturday, August 19th, noon to 6 p.m. at Cider Riot. There will be fabulous books, DVDs, CDs, and vinyl at ridiculously low prices. It's a fun community event that benefits your favorite